Good evening. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 in the greater Portland metropolitan area, 91.9 in Hood River, White Salmon, Washington, the Dalles, up and down the Columbia River Gorge, and in Corvallis, Albany, Salem, that is 100.7, and on the wonderful World Wide Web. You can tell your friends far and wide to point and click at KBOO.FM. This is Proverbial Perspectives, the third Thursday segment, hosted by Celeste Carey. And, as usual, we're bringing you some news that pertains to brightening of our worlds here. Little Proverbial Perspectives brings you public affairs, news, information, especially from the Black community, but more globally from folks of color and the community at large. And on a more local note, I do have an announcement here, which will give you an opportunity to have some local dialogue about issues that are important to the Black community here in Portland. And that is a book discussion salon. You have an opportunity on Friday, March 17th, from 7 to 9 p.m., to discuss the book by Michael Dyson, Is Bill Cosby Right, or Has the Black Middle Class Lost His Mind? And there is only one requirement, that you have read the book. So those of you who have read the book and or will read the book by that time are more than warmly invited to participate in the conversation. There are copies available at the bookstore. Multnomah County Library does have, I believe, two copies in circulation. And you, of course, can bother your friends and find out if they have a copy, borrow their copy, and hopefully not underscore it too much. At any rate, to participate in this, you only have to come to Talking Drum Cafe. And again, as I said, Friday, March 17th, from 7 to 9 p.m., this event is free and open to the public, and you will find the Talking Drum Book and Cafe Retreat at 446 Northeast Killingsworth. For more information, you can call Gloria at 503-288-4070. Hope that you enjoy it, and there's an opportunity to find out a little bit more about what's going on both internally within the Black community and externally is how we and others see ourselves. Take care. Now, here's another opportunity to have a discussion with folks who are making changes in the community, being bright lights in the community, and trying to connect the community. For those of you who work in the nonprofit world, you know, sometimes you find that in the biblical sense, you're trying to make walls and bricks and buildings out of sometimes less than straw. And it can be daunting work. It can be very difficult work. It can be tiring and thankless work. But then again, when you find you have the right tools and you can make the right connections, not only do you find that many hands make light labor, but the skills in those hands also make light the labor. Well, how do you prepare the hands? How do you get them the skills they need? The Institute for Nonprofit Management is one place where you can learn these tools. I myself have had the opportunity of taking classes with that institute. I've had some of the best times, some of the best education, some of the most fun, and I guess I'd say some opportunities for some lasting inspiration has come from my association with the Institute for Nonprofit Management. And I have with me here today three bright lights who have matriculated from the program. And I'm looking forward to not only showing off their skills and having them to show you why they are bright lights, but possibly inspire someone out there to participate and to carry their education and their learning that extra step further so that in the nonprofit arena in which they find themselves moving, that they can make that change and they can be the change that they want to see. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce my three stars here and have them tell you all about what has inspired them and helped them maintain their stellar orbits. You're on, gentlemen.
All right, well.
I love that speechless moment. It's called We Are Sincere, and what you're really talking about is yes.
And that was very nice of you. I'm Jamal Folsom, and I started the Leadership Fellows Program back in 2000. I was with the second class, and I started that program as a program officer at the Black United Fund of Oregon.
Okay.
Good evening. My name is James Kent, and I was part of the very first class. We like to be known as the Alpha Class. We also like to be known as the Rough Draft.
The Rough Draft?
Yes, ma'am.
That's right.
I would say that you would be the tough act to follow. See, that's
very
how you do
so.
It.
Very much so.
Okay, James, and so where are you now?
I am currently working with Multnomah County with the Department of School and Community Partnerships under the directorship of Mr. Lorenzo Poe.
Okay.
And good evening. My name is Sean Derrickson. And when I started out with the fellowship program, I was working as a child family therapist at Morrison Child and Family Services. And that was back in the year 2000 with Jamal in class two. And currently I am working in Multnomah County in the Mental Health and Addiction Services Division as the supervisor for the community-based outreach team.
Oh, you're somebody I need to talk to later. I have a program that will make you smile.
Sure.
Okay. So first and foremost, tell us, who is the Institute for Nonprofit Management? That's such a long and almost formidable title, but it seems to be very accessible and to have made a tremendous difference for those who've been able to basically attend classes and participate.
Well, a little history with the Institute for Nonprofit Management started when CEOs and directors of nonprofit management or organizations began to notice that the line of succession was not there in terms of leadership that came about after someone left. Portland is notorious for bringing in very, very talented people of color who on an average stay between 3 and 5 years. And what they began to notice is that during that time, once folks began to leave and transition and go on to other jobs, you probably noticed in the introduction that the three of us now work for municipalities. We are all in government now.
Local government.
Yes, ma'am. And that's tended to be what happens when you train and get folks, you know, ready for the next level. But unfortunately, the downside of it for nonprofit organizations is that you lose them. Once you lose a level of leadership, they tend to wane and go away. We've lost several very impacting organizations in the past, and the Institute for Nonprofit Management basically was a group of, like I said, the directors who said we have to do something to get our folks ready and trained to move into those positions on the next level, and how do we do it? And they went and spoke with Erna Gellis, Suzanne Feeney, and at the time I think it was also the current president of PSU,
Dr. Bernstein,
who worked with them to develop a curriculum for the program, and from that point it's flourished, it's taken off.
And the institute is under the School of, is it Business and Public Administration?
It's the Mark Hatfield School of Government.
Okay, Mark Hatfield School of Government. Mm-hmm. Now, that's an interesting fit. Not only the fact that you have matriculated from nonprofit to government, but the fact that government has seen the need to support nonprofit. Mm-hmm. Is that because of an enlightened vision and understanding how the two of them kind of mesh together and work together, and it takes at least those two partners to be successful in making social change, economic change, et cetera?
Well, it definitely, this is Jamal again, it definitely takes at least the two to be successful. And at the same time, I think there is more of a role that government can do in stepping up to the plate of partnership, especially in shoring up resources for the program. Much of the work of the agencies that are staffed by leadership fellows is are contractors of the city, contractors of the county. And really and truthfully, the Institute for Nonprofit Management and the Leadership Fellows Program allows these agencies to do the work that they do better. It's a better use of public resources. And at the moment, I definitely see room where some of our agencies, some of our bosses can actually step up and help pay for some of the programs.
Excellent, excellent. Given the fact that the, I guess, then leadership within nonprofit, the CEOs and administrators of nonprofits at that time decided to come together and to make this happen, what kind of results do you think they saw within the next few years? Was this a slow-to-move process, or was this something that caught on and people were really quick to recognize the benefit of the Institute and take advantage of it?
Well, you know, I think it's good to be clear. There's a distinction, though. So we're talking about the Leadership Fellows Program, of which all of us went through, which is a part of or comes out of the Institute for Nonprofit Management at Portland State University. And you were talking about in the beginning the coming together of the executive directors of color and came together to start the Fellows Program.
The Fellows Program.
Okay. All right. So, go ahead.
Okay. No. I'm just explain how they are different and how they fit together.
Well, the Leadership Fellows Program is a separate program, a program within the Institute of Nonprofit Management.
Okay.
The Institute of Nonprofit Management has a full curriculum of different courses and things that they offer the community.
Undergraduate and graduate.
People can get their doctorate, those types of things. Whereas the Leadership Fellows Program was more focused specifically on developing leaders of color for those nonprofit organizations that were typically run and meant for, communities of color.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I wanted to mention, too, about why there's a focus on nonprofit is because nonprofits traditionally have been able to be more dynamic and more flexible to meet the needs of the community at a quicker rate than, say, a governmental agency or some even for-profit agencies, that they can respond to the needs at a much quicker level without having to wait for, like, procurements and budget processes and
right.
votes and all those kind of things, contracts and all that stuff. It's an important part that they do contracting and those types of things, but they traditionally, again, have been able to respond much more quickly and meet those needs of the community, in real time.
Yeah, so going back to your question of has it taken on, I'd say so. I mean, the first year of fellows, I don't know, there were probably, how many folks were in your class?
At least 26.
At least 26, and I think they were about the same in ours. But mm-hmm. within a couple of years, we realized through the interaction of the fellows from the alpha class and from our class, the beta
Betas.
Class.
Beta class.
They had no choice but to accept that name.
And what was the third class? Through that interaction, we began to realize that there was this pretty large web of resources and networks that have begun to get established through the connections that we were making, with connections of some of the other fellows. And eventually it has taken on to be, as what we say, is a quiet revolution in Portland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely the networking was very important. I know myself at the time when I was working as a child family therapist, I was actually working with a lot of families that had severe and intense needs, and oftentimes the agency that I worked for could not meet all of those needs, nor could any of the governmental agencies that were a part of that. But there may be a piece I could get from one of the other nonprofits that a fellow was at. I could call up James at the time. I believe you were working at SEI.
Yes.
James, do you have a room I can use to do this thing? And he would arrange for that to happen, those sort of things. So we all started to really work together and network. And right now we have over 140 fellows that are in the program that are, some are at the federal level, some are at state, some are at the various counties throughout the state of Oregon.
Some have moved on to the private sector.
Some have moved on to the private sector, yes.
But the benefit in this, though, is even though we are no longer a nonprofit and we're all working in government, I don't know if I mentioned in the beginning, but I work in City Commissioner Eric Sten's office, and what we bring is that perspective of the needs of nonprofit organizations, and especially the perspective of serving communities of color. And that from my experience, has been a pretty significant void in local government.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
it's a valuable thing to bring to the table as we move on from our nonprofit perspectives to the private sector, to the public sector.
One of the other really important assets of the program that began to show up within a couple of years is the relationships that began to form between nonprofit agencies that may have traditionally not worked together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Specifically
yes.
in the arena of family services, mental health even. I know specifically as a director of programs for Urban League at the time, we had a very difficult time being able to enter into and properly serve Latino families. And so being a traditionally African-American organization, there was a gap there. So what we did, what I did, was call on my other fellows. We had an opportunity for work with folks who were from Latino backgrounds, Native American, Asian, and I think we had inclusive of another group. Actually, we kind of grew it into the last two that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. But the difference was that those of us who were in these positions of directors and managers and so forth were in very key positions where funding and we were advocating for our communities. And oftentimes there were moments of tension where there had never been a across-the-table conversation about resources and what do we do when the pie isn't big enough and what do we do, how do we separate out the crumbs between us. And from that, I think, grew a very strong advocacy group for any level of funding that began to come down through the city of Portland, whereas we knew...
And the
that,
county.
And the county.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that we had allies who had been working with us, training with us, and had a perspective that we did, that certain barriers would no longer be a problem once we reached that part in the road.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 here, FM. This is Proverbial Perspectives, third Thursday segment with Celeste Curie, and I'm speaking with three former leadership fellows, participants. I feel like you need another title, though. Leadership participants.
We're fellows.
We're fellows, I guess. Once
okay.
A fellow, always a fellow.
Always a fellow. Great.
Yes.
One of the things that I found really unique to the Leadership Fellows program was the curriculum. And you've got three overarching areas of training. And then I understand that it's customized to each class according to their need. Before you tell me a little bit about the three areas, how do they determine how they want to customize it? Is it basically looking at a profile of the current nominees or the candidates and then also a combination of conversations with them, what they need, or is there another process that you determine how to customize it, as they say?
Well, I think there are seven different levels. One would be, as part of a nominations committee or whatnot, we would review kind of what are the CV, the curriculum vitalities of the people that are involved in the program, as well as, you know, with the experience of the Institute of Nonprofit Management, Susan Feeney and Erna Gellis, that they had a good idea of what were needs in the nonprofit community that people would need to be in a position of leadership. So they developed kind of a curriculum that we'd use at the first part of the fellowship program, which was a summer immersion program where we would go away for a week and have an intense group experience. I guess that would be a piece to it.
Just to be clear, though, if I can jump in, it was more than just Suzanne,
yes.
Suzanne and Erna, which is critical. They partnered with folks in the community from several key agencies, OCHA, Black United Fund,
Volunteers of America,
Urban League, all headed by solid people of color.
Who were able to kind of assess what kind of talents and skills were needed
overall
in the Portland community.
Exactly. So with the expertise of Suzanne and Erna in terms of
academic.
Exactly. They brought that community perspective of this is what's needed to train and develop the leaders who are serving our communities. So sorry to cut you off, but
no problem.
Well, that's a great segue, because then that kind of explains how they came up with at least one area of the curriculum that I find really intriguing. There's three overarching areas I mentioned. There's the cultural context of leadership and community, leadership development, and nonprofit organization management. The nuts and bolts, I guess you'd say.
Yes.
But it's the cultural context that really I think is fascinating. And as an outsider, that seems to be not only unique, but perhaps the pivotal point that makes a difference within communities of color of successful leadership. And within the area of the cultural context of leadership and community, there's storytelling, spirituality, cultural histories, for example, striking the balance, reflection, and journaling it, and then communicating across cultures. As former participants, as current fellows, how important was that particular component to your education?
It was crucial.
It's critical. Yes.
Okay.
It's critical.
That's what I thought. What was it that was the defining moment, if I could get out of you, just about having that as different from, you know, the everyday academia, having something that rooted you and your altruistic desires culturally? What was that like?
Wow. Wow, that's a big question. I know for myself, one of the things is growing up as a Chicano in California, for me, I gained a lot from the cultural experience that I received from meeting other Chicanos up in Oregon. When I moved up here, you know, 20-plus years ago, there weren't very many other Latinos, especially in education where I was going to college and other things like that. So one of the things for me is for my generation of Latinos is I was not taught Spanish. It was forbidden within my home in my generation because of racism and other things that they had seen. And
it was a protective mechanism.
Exactly. But that had a piece of isolation for me, especially coming up here where you felt different. You didn't, even when you would run into other Latinos, most of them were, you know, first generation who were speaking Spanish or monolingual. You couldn't communicate, but you just didn't feel right. And for me, it was very powerful to run into other fellows throughout the program, many of whom were much older than I, who had the exact same experience. And so for my just individual culture, there was more about learning about myself that was very powerful as the program progressed. One of the other things I really appreciate is a defining moment is that we had one of our instructors at the Summer Immersion Program came in, and we all as a group kind of sat down and listed, you know, what are the issues that affect your community as Latinos, as Native Americans, as African Americans? What are those issues and the pros and cons about being of that culture from our perspective? And we wrote all those down. And it was amazing that other than just a couple minor things that we really saw, that there was a lot of uniformity between all communities of color. And I think that was very powerful for us to see that, you know, as Jane was alluding to earlier, we've always been fighting over the little pieces of crumb, maybe,
right,
you know, of the pie. Maybe we should get together and, as a universal front, ask for a bigger piece of pie. Mm-hmm. And that was a very powerful piece. And then learning just more about each other's cultures, what we like to eat for breakfast, what we like to eat for lunch, how we, you know, have a celebration, how we dance, how we do these things.
And how we keep our histories, how we share.
Yes.
From generation to generation. So in terms of having this cultural component, it sounds like this was almost a spiritual coalition building.
Mm-hmm.
In other
yes.
words, to help you not only relate to your culture, as you were saying, Sean, and come out of that isolation, that vacuum, but then to also to see your commonalities and start building a coalition, not on a practical level, but on a spiritual level,
right.
You know,
yes.
in terms of your vision, creating
right.
that collective vision. And I guess one of the reasons why I'm trying to emphasize that is one of the things that you hear people complain about in Portland is being able to have that kind of visceral contact and connection with people, both within their own communities and across communities. And that's the soul of coalition building. You don't mm-hmm. hear that or
is.
Feel that often enough.
It truly is, and it's something that you cannot measure.
Right.
You cannot measure it. I mean, we attempted to do it with the resource mapping project,
mm-hmm.
where we list the amount of the critical contacts that we have before going into the Fellows Program and the critical contacts we developed outside of the once we've gone through the program, and then looked at that against all the other fellows, and I mean that's just the tip of the iceberg, but the relationship that you establish and that you develop comes back in play years down the line. I remember after a couple years after our class was over, going into a meeting, and Oscar Sween Lopez was coming into a meeting with the commissioner and advocating on behalf of an issue for the Latino Network. And there was something about having gone through that experience and having learned what his experience had been in his various organizations that really allowed me to be able to advocate on behalf of not only that particular issue, but at the bigger level for the Latino community. It really kind of set aside whatever preconceived notions I might have had in terms of doing such.
Mm. You know, it's not necessarily an easy process either.
No.
I mean,
yeah,
the nice thing about
that,
the fellowship
yeah.
program was that it allowed a venue for everyone to feel safe enough to be
yes.
able to vent, to ask the tough questions. You know, I've always wondered why you wore that or you did this or, you know, why mm-hmm. is it that you eat this certain way or do, you know, and we were... we were safe enough to be able to ask those questions. And there were tense times. I mean, I have to admit that. We went through the normal group processes of Storman and Norman and all that kind of stuff, those theory stuff, you know. But, you know, it allowed that to happen. And I haven't had an experience, you know, elsewhere where I've been able to do that or to have that freedom to be able to ask those tough questions and then to be able to apply the answers. You know, myself as a therapist, I learned a lot about the African-American community. I never would have learned had I not been part of the fellowship program that then helped me directly the next day when I was working with a family, you know, to feel a level of cultural competence, you know, that I had never had before, or just even know that maybe I should be asking these questions, or maybe I should question myself and what I'm feeling about this, and should I check in with James over here or Jamal, you know, what do you feel about this, you know, these kind of issues. I don't know what the experience was. James, maybe you want to talk about that?
Yeah, you know, you mentioned a little bit about defining moments, and I think I've probably been one of the most blessed ones out of all the groups, because I've had the opportunity, like starting the third year, to go back and facilitate and help narrate and MC the summer intern program. And so I've kind of went through it with at least four or five different classes where you get this, like you mentioned, Sean, storming and norming, you know, but those are traditional, you know, European words that,
right.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
We went through it is what we did. We went through it, each class did, because I think one of those aha moments for me was when we all realized that our style of leadership as people of color is so different than anyone else's. Mm-hmm. And we've been traditionally taught that the way we lead and the way we lead our people is not
healthy.
And it's not, it doesn't work for them. But what the fellows did was allow us to kind of pull back our own personal layers of insecurity, and even looking at how we have criticized each other and our own community, and really not giving it an opportunity and a chance to value the service or the skills that we all have. Mm. And then when we really start understanding that, it's a very intense moment, because we realize that everything that we think that we need or want for our communities, we have it within our groups. We have it within our networking. And the way in which we've been able to grow as individuals as well as organizations by the connection that we've had, it still isn't able to be measured, I don't think. I don't think we've had the opportunity to really look at how far-reaching the effects have been.
Yeah, going back to another question that you had earlier, which was how they developed the curriculum, kind of tie into what you just said, a huge part of the program is evaluation.
Yes.
Evaluation. Mm-hmm. At the end of each session, I mean, they carved out time and would not let us go.
No dinner tickets until you evaluate.
Right. Uh-huh. Usually I was the last one there, giving right in War and Peace. Asking the fellows what worked for you, what didn't work for you, how would you improve, and they would take that feedback to heart, and they would use that to reshape sometimes the next class. I mean, when I say the next class,
you mean in your your curriculum and your course time.
Exactly.
That's fascinating.
Because we'd say at the beginning, we want to learn more about ethical leadership or succession planning, and by the end of our first year cohort, we would have that, or we would have that within the summer retreat. Is in between the summer residential immersion program that James was talking about earlier, where we all come together for a week for the first time to get to know each other. I'm beyond getting to know each other, but it's an immersion program. It's like a week of intense learning. once a month, we come together for a full day session on a particular topic and future courses within that year, as well as the overall curriculum for years after that, were also informed by the evaluation.
And the quality instruction was excellent. I have to admit that it was very nice that they brought in both local experts and national, state, other experts from around to give us the skills to really use in our daily jobs. You know, one of the things that I found that was powerful for me is that I would confront an issue on Monday. Mm-hmm. You know, I would go to a class on Tuesday. I'd have one of those aha moments. Well, that's what's going on here. And then on Wednesday, I was applying the skills that I had learned the day before. And understanding that, not being frustrated, you know, knowing what those issues were. And had I not gone to that class, I would have been as frustrated as I was on Monday.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that seems really fascinating to me, and again, the reason I'm spending so much time discussing this whole spiritual and cultural and visceral connection is, again, that really is the glue that not only holds it together, but it's the propellant force that moves what you have done out into the community. And Jamal, when you were talking about leadership succession planning, looking forward to that, quite often here in the community, you don't have groups understanding how much talent there is within communities of color. And I hear so often, well, we just can't find any qualified minorities. Mm-hmm. Now, hearing that, having that spiritual, that visceral connection between yourselves and your classes, how can we work to overcome that? Because I know that's got to really thwart you all when you've had this training. You know you are what people will call the cream of the crop, and yet people are still saying you don't exist.
I wince every time I hear it, especially in government, especially mm-hmm. in government. And it's that, I think, if there's a true commitment to diversifying the workplace, then you have to diversify the way you go about recruitment.
Amen.
And you have to recruit in different venues, different formats. And much like this curriculum for leadership development was very different than your traditional leadership development. I mean, I don't know of many other leadership programs that focus on spirituality or that uh-huh. have a spirituality component, which is a critical piece within the Black community, within the Chicano community, and
mm-hmm.
and
with the Native, any community of color.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. I mean, it is something that we bring with us in our everyday, but in mainstream dominant culture, it's almost like it's, you know, you walk on eggshells when you get around to talking about your faith in the workplace. I mean, you just don't do it. But my point is, if that commitment is there, then you go about recruitment in a different way. And yeah.
Well, you've actually given me the perfect segue to talk about recruitment. I know that this is the season within the Leadership Fellows cycle for nominations, for bringing people on board. Mm-hmm. I've nominated a few people in my time. I don't think any of them actually made it through. And one of them is because they just had other commitments. But I know that if you believe in somebody and you want to have them take advantage of this opportunity, how would you bring someone forward to the Leadership Fellows program to be considered?
Well, I'm going to let Jamal tell you the technical way, but I'm going to tell you the way in which you got to start thinking first.
Okay.
You got to start thinking, put my money where my mouth is.
Hello.
You have to be ready to invest mm-hmm. in the talent that you have. Unfortunately, too many nonprofits look at their organizations, the ones that are more grassroots, communities of color, as a springboard for folks to go from here to somewhere else. So you don't get them investing in the talent. You don't get them sending them to trainings. You don't get updated training. You don't get them being exposed to different levels of the organization. So
yes.
It starts with a mentality. If you really want your organization to grow with the talent you have, both raw talent and those folks who you know brought it with them mm-hmm. And you trained them, you have to start thinking, I have it. And then you start talking to your CFO and saying, do we have it? Can we invest it? Because there is a monetary investment with the Fellows program. But even before you get there, you got to be committed. I like to talk about my first class because we were the first class. We actually had our CEOs who were part of our class. And I think that was it the second year as well, or was it only the
your
first year?
Your CEOs participated at the same time
yes.
some of you were?
Yeah, they went through the class, the summer
That's
intern
beautiful.
Program, like we did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it kind of dropped off after the first year because the investment. They figured,
right.
well, you know, we'll send our folks and we'll send our good people in. But unfortunately, it's something that you really have to invest in through the whole organization from the top down and follow it through. Ours
right.
was a two-year program at the time, and we really needed that buy-in. And then folks needed, once they got through, an opportunity. You
right.
can train folks and give them all they need, but guarantee you once they are done and you don't have a place for them, then they'll end up at the city, at Multnomah
uh-huh.
County, and state government.
Well, you know, you said something that's really critical by place for them, not just a job, mm-hmm. but a willingness within the organization to embrace the changes that they bring
exactly.
forward.
To grow.
Because if you're going to train them and make them new wine,
yes.
and then you bring them back and put them in an old wine skin, it won't change.
Yes.
You wasted your money,
yes,
and
you've
wasted the whole opportunity for a quantum leap.
Yes, you did.
So now, we've got organizations that want to bite, and they want to be a part of this. How can you nominate someone? And Jamal, he did give you the technical aspect.
Yeah.
And you know.
Well, that's perfect. So what you can do to nominate a person within your organization or someone that you know to be a participant in the Leadership Fellows Program is to simply call the Fellows Program. You can call 725-8221, and that's the Institute for Nonprofit Management. You can also go to the website and pick up a nomination form. And let's see, what else can you do?
You can also be in touch with some of the other organizations who've actually had participants being in the Leadership Fellows. Mm-hmm. There's, you guys can help me list them. There's Morrison Center, mm-hmm. Self Enhancement Incorporated, Urban League of Portland, Black United Fund, Janice Youth, House of Emoja,
Urban League,
Friends of the Children.
Yeah, Friends of Children. What's the other one?
Janice Youth Programs.
Out Front House, whether or not around anymore. But there's a lot of organizations who've actually already participated, who folks are already working with. And the reason why I mention them is because you can go and ask them the value that sending their folks to the Leadership Fellows has brought to their organization.
You know, and it also might take some convincing to the nominee mm-hmm. as well. I was nominated for the program by one of my folks who worked at the Black United Fund at the time, who went through the program, and she said it was great and she really recommended it and I should do it.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came time to actually do the application, I had something else going on and just did not want to take the time to do something else that was going to require me to go to more meetings.
Well,
it's a significant time commitment.
It is a time commitment because, if I'm not mistaken, don't you have to go away for about a week or two in the summer?
A week.
A week in the summer, and then you still afterwards have serious increments of time that you have to really concentrate.
Absolutely. But it's circling back to the value that you get out of the program, not only during the time that you're involved, but afterwards. And the website for the Leadership Fellows Program is www.leadershipfellows.pdx.edu. And you can go and click on, or you can download both the cover letter and the nomination form. If you want to go directly to that, leadershipfellows.pdx.edu/nomination.html.
And we'll have this information at the front desk, too, if people are curious. Or, as Jamal said, you could just go to www.leadershipfellows, one word, leadershipfellows.pdx.edu, and it will take you through.
And I believe the nominations are due at the end of this month. The deadline to nominate is coming around really soon. In April, and at the end of this month and most of next month, they will notify eligible recipients or eligible nominees.
Yeah. We mentioned also, too, that the summer immersion program, actually this particular year, it'll take place at the very last week of summer, mm-hmm. which will be September 17th, I believe, through the 22nd or 23rd, or mm-hmm. 24th, actually. So it'll help out because a lot of folks tend to be vacationing or doing what they do in the summer, so we wanted to be able to capture that time so that it's convenient.
Now, there's one other question I want to ask you, and this goes back to something we said earlier with regard to being recognized as a body of knowledge, as a legitimate body of knowledge. How do you promote yourselves as the think tank, as the nonprofit think tank? How do the fellows make sure that people understand you are a viable resource out here? Because quite often, I've heard nonprofits, I've heard various other organizations say, as I said, that, well, there's no people of color out here who are qualified or who want to do this or are able to do it. Yet we have, at least four classes mm-hmm. of fellows who are out here who are ready and committed, and when I say committed, I'm not just talking about in terms of the head, but of the heart, of the spirit, to making a difference in the community, yet nobody asked you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do we advocate for you so people know you're out there as a think tank, a resource?
Well, you know, this medium right here today now is one of the best ways. I don't think we've done too much in the way of advertising, being on radio spots, making public, you know, meetings and telling folks about what the fellows is all about. It's been word of mouth. It's been folks who are in the community who know about it and who know folks who are in the fellows, and they say, hey, why don't you guys, you know, we've got this thing, you got the expertise, why don't you come and be a part of it? it's the part of Leadership Fellows that is still developmental and growing, but it starts with opportunities like we have today. And I'm sure that the plan is to grow it from this opportunity. So we thank you for this first opportunity.
You know, for me, it was just a matter of networking and degrees of separation and trying to put those connections together. So then I have another question. If we wanted to have you come together as a group or a partial group and have the benefit of the knowledge, the collective wisdom of the fellows, how could we connect with you? Is there a point of contact so that we could bring you in on forums, roundtables, community meetings, any opportunity to really get some fresh insight on how to address a lot of problems? I participate in a lot of problem-solving groups, both for my job and for my community work, and it's really valuable to know where the strength and the wit and the spirit is.
Well, I think contacting the Institute of Nonprofit Management would be probably the first step. We do have a listserv that probably all the fellows are on, I imagine.
Absolutely.
And we have... I think that would be, and again, that's the 503-725-8221 phone number.
Give that slowly for those who are running to their ink pens.
That's 503-725-8221.
Excellent.
And you can submit, you can call there, and they can, I don't know if there's something here that, again, you can email at leadershipfellows@pdx.edu if you had a request or something, and that can be put on the listserv.
Absolutely.
And it would go out to all the fellows. And then, you know, as today, that's how we all wound up here, is that we got a listserv announcement that there was a call to come here and talk about the fellows program. And so we volunteered and came on down.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Sharon Hassenjaeger is the keeper of that list. And she's great in terms of getting stuff out to the list in a timely manner.
Yes, everything from job announcements to other opportunities for things like think tanks, conferences, seminars, other trainings, those sorts of things are all broadcast on that listserv for the fellows to look at.
Great.
Grant opportunities, those sort of things.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wish I could have you even a little longer. I know you've got other commitments, but as we kind of wrap this up, I know that I have left a chunk of questions I'd love to ask you out, and even have you maybe come back another time and talk to the community, maybe pick a couple of topics either that are close to your heart or the community's heart, and just kind of talk about them. That's, as you said, one of the beauties of community radio is we get to do that. We don't have to worry about commercials. Mm-hmm. We just worry about creating community. But as you are about to go and you're about to go back to your various pursuits, what is one thing that you would either like to say to induce somebody to participate, to induce somebody to utilize, or to share about, again, an epiphany that you had, or just how valuable this opportunity was for you?
I'll let someone else start.
Go ahead, Sean.
No, that's a tough question. You know, you have to value who you have in your organization, and I think all of our organizations probably did. The way that I got to the table was to be nominated by my CEO, who then gave me the opportunities to experience what I was learning on a daily basis in the organization that I was a part of at that time. And I think it's critical that our community recognize that there are these members within our community that are willing to be cultivated, to become leaders, to make actual changes. You know, the proof is in the pudding. You know, some of it is a silent revolution, but, you know, all of us have moved on to more responsible roles now where we are actively working to help change systems for the betterment of our community. And that I think, is being recognized daily probably from our employers. And I think for the community as a whole to support a program like this, it's benefiting itself in doing that. Our community has better resources. The needs are met more effectively by having homegrown leaders, so that we have people that are familiar with our community, that have grown up here, have spent many years here, you know,
who
are invested. Mm-hmm. You know, my children go to Portland Public Schools. You know, those are very important things that we're very invested within this community.
The one part I think I would emphasize again is that whole thinking part of it. And as an individual who may very well think I'm ready to step up to that next level of leadership, really the introspective part of it, in terms of are you ready to be a leader, is the part that one needs to contemplate to a very deep level. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's the very first day of the summer intern program, is dealing with you. dealing with your shadows, dealing with what you bring, dealing with how you as an individual affect yourself, the individuals around you, your community, and eventually how you affect the world. So if folks are ready for that quote-unquote next level of leadership, this is the place where they would hone those skills. And the question really is, are you really ready? Because leadership can be a very lonely, very isolated, and very much a targeted position.
It's a challenge, yes.
You have to be ready for that call.
You know, in terms of being ready, I think the piece that I'd like to leave us with is us who have gone through the Leadership Fellows Program is taking our leadership to the next level and working to garner the support needed to sustain the program. I mean, we know that as with any funded program, grant-funded program, there's always the danger of it not being around. We all know that funders, including us in government, like to see sustainability. And at this point, we as fellows need to shore up our own contributions. We need to take it back to our bosses and talk about the value that we've seen, not only in ourselves, but in our peers who have gone on to become executive directors of organizations, who have gone on to do great things within larger nonprofits like Providence Health Systems, or move on to the private sector. And make that contribution. We also need to take this out to private sector organizations who also see the value and the benefit of having a qualified workforce, a diversified workforce to choose from, those who have benefited from the program, and ask them to shore up resources. With that, I think we should then look at getting some sort of match, some sort of public match from government entities or retake that back to the foundations and look at how it is that we can put together a package to sustain the program.
Well, not only that, but I think the more the community hears how valuable you are, and I don't mean in a large abstract sense, but I mean in a very real concrete and relational sense, the more you will be able to get that community support. Because you're right, you do need the pillars. You do need the government. You do need the private sector. And you do need the nonprofits to come back. But it's the everyday ordinary person who is able to make a contribution that can help out. Mm-hmm. And to that end, I would tell people, if you have questions, to call that phone number. And, Sean, you have it now.
503-725-8221.
Excellent. And find out more ways to be involved. It could be that you nominate someone. It could be that you support the program. The thing that I think is most wonderful about this is that many of the people who have gone through this program are homegrown people, as you've all mentioned. People that you've probably seen grow up, whose nose you may have wiped, who you may have hugged or encouraged or sent money for college books or whatever. But it's an opportunity to see people flower and realize all of their potential. And you mentioned earlier that this is a quiet revolution that's going on here in Greater Portland area, Jamal. And I know that's part of what we hear from the Leadership Fellows program. I want to call it mantra. But basically, this is an opportunity for Portland to create the change that Portland wishes to see. If we want to take this community to the next level, this is what it takes. This is what must be done. This is what it entails. And so I really want to thank you all for coming out. We're sorry that we didn't get, you know, a few more people, because I would have loved to have had Tasha here to represent, you know, the feminine perspective.
Yes.
So don't think that the fellows are just fellows.
No. We are
not just
fellows.
It's just a collective term, you know, and you have quite a bit of participation for women. But for those of you who are listening, if you know someone that you think is really qualified to take a nonprofit venture to the next level, and they want to do so for themselves, all you have to do is contact the radio station for more information or call PSU. And there's a generic phone number, too, as well, that's easy to remember. 725, is it 3000?
3000.
Yes, 725-3000. We want to thank you. I want to thank you. I want to invite you back again.
Most definitely. Sure.
Because I want to tap into your problem-solving skills and that spiritual altruism, the one that says, we can get this done, you know,
absolutely.
And I will make sure it happens.
Love to.
Thanks for having us. Thank you so much,
Jamal and James and Sean. And thank you to Erna for helping me put this together. And thank you to all the KABU listening family that continues to support KABU as a nonprofit, non-commercial, community-based venture. This has been Proverbial Perspectives. So let's carry with the Third Thursday segment. Be sure to listen because we have Shahid Hamid, Bruce Broussard, who also hold it down for Proverbial Perspectives. And then we also have Gutars Ektadari as he comes in for Voices from the Wilderness. This is your community connection, KBOO-FM. Stay tuned because we have good times coming up here in your community.